Hello, everyone, and welcome to another expert interview in the Innovation and Creativity Summit 2017. I'm very happy to have Dr. James C. Kaufman with me today. And Dr. Kaufman is a professor at the University of Connecticut and author of the book Creativity 101. It's lovely to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, for people who aren't aware of you and the research that you do, can you just give us a background into how you got into creativity research and what your specialty is?
Sure. I was a creative writer. I was, as an undergrad, double major in creative writing and psychology, leaning towards creative writing, and then decided to fall back on psychology and get my PhD. And I decided may as well study the thing that is of most interest to me. I didn't really realize that you could study creativity, but I was lucky enough to work with a professor, Bob Sternberg, who was big in the area. And once I discovered it, fell in love with it.
So is this what you highlight in your book, Creativity 101? Is it more geared towards the academic side teaching students, or is it something that a layman can understand as well?
There's a term that we use called educated layman, like somebody, so it's not layperson at the level of necessarily airplane reading. So I don't know if you would like get a nice glass of wine and some cheese and read Creativity 101, although I would be thrilled if you did. But it also is not terribly jargony. I don't go into the boring stuff as much as I can avoid it. And I try using a lot of examples and what I'm told is somewhat successful humor to convey a lot of the points.
But I think the big important thing about books like this is they give a view into creativity, which is actually based on the scientific evidence which is out there at the moment, rather than just people's ideas about how creativity works from their own experience.
Yes. Creativity is kind of a weird field in that because everybody is creative, everybody has ideas on the topic, you know, the same way that everybody's writing a novel. People don't feel that about other fields. There aren't people who have their own pet theory of nuclear physics. And you end up with a lot of weird cluttering of the market. You end up with a lot, and how would people know what's right and what's not right when everybody can say they have a degree or something? So it's there's a lot of very good stuff, there's a lot of less good stuff.
And that's exactly one of the reasons why I wanted to put together this summit with experts like yourself and like some of the other doctors who are actually studying the subject on a day-to-day basis and rigorously peer-reviewing the evidence which is being put out there. Because a lot of people don't actually realize how much study is going into the subject and how many journal articles are written about it every month.
It's a growing topic. It's been studied for almost 70 years, and there's somewhere between 6 and 8 journals devoted just to creativity research. In general, whenever somebody says that one particular thing works and there's no debate over it, they tend to not know what they're talking about, because we can disagree about everything, and most of the disagreement is stupid things, but it's rare to have any totally consistent, everybody agrees, this is the answer, just do this one thing.
So let's dive a bit more into that. I'm personally aware of a lot of bad advice out there, which is from people who say, this is how creativity worked for me, or this is how creativity worked at Apple, because I read it on an article somewhere. And this is how Einstein was creative versus how this is how Mozart was creative. And they essentially give these lists of motivational quotes about how they could do it, so can you. What are the myths out there which you see that people quote, either statistics which aren't actually true or just plain old falsehoods which aren't backed up by the evidence or actually disproven by the evidence?
Certainly, anything that sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. Anything where it's you do this one thing, it's a cause and effect problem. So if you want to be creative, have a messier desk. I mean, there's a number of problems with that study, but even regardless of that, even if people who are creative tend to have messy desks don't make you creative. It's the whole thing about how there's more crime committed when ice cream sales go up. Ice cream sales don't cause crime. It's that it means that it's summer and your windows are open, people can burglarize you, and you want to buy ice cream. And so there's a lot of stuff like that. There's also a lot of stuff that's based off of one small study. I mean, anything in general about the physical environment, it's very rare to have that repeatedly shown to be true. So have a plant nearby, or have your walls colored green, or take a jog, or whatever. All this stuff, for every study that says yes, another study says no, and a third study says none of this matters at all.
If you don't mind, could I run you through a couple of the myths of creativity and just ask you to basically say there's a lot of evidence to support this, there's some evidence to support this, but there's basically no evidence to support this. I'm sorry, I've got a bit of a tickly throat today. So the first one is quite a common one. People say that if you want to have better ideas, then get outside and get away from your desk and essentially put your mind in a bit more of a relaxed mood.
It probably won't hurt, but there aren't any particular studies. Most of the outdoor type studies are based on very small ends, and they involve things like going on a 20-minute hike, not just walking around. I mean, that would be an example of, I guess, a harmless thing, and that it probably won't hurt you, and that it's, I mean, hopefully you're not counting on that change of location to give you a brilliant insight. If you're just trying it, and hey, if it works for you, do it. I mean, it's not like you're injecting yourself with something poisonous. I mean, but
I
there's
mean
not a
that might lead us on to the next myth, which is a lot of people see great creatives as suffering from things like alcohol or drug dependency. Do those substances help get you in a more creative mindset?
no. Tons of research. Couple of studies are show connections, most show no connections. Almost all the genius stuff is anecdotes, and most importantly, again, it's that chicken and egg. I mean, do well-known creative people end up going to drugs or alcohol because they're rich and are just dealing with a lot of pressure? Or do
And the
that
ones that are successful enough for us to remember.
And it's not like we don't make lists of people who didn't have drug or alcohol problems. And there's been a number of studies that show that people will think they're more creative when they're on drugs, but they're not.
Yeah. What about listening to specific types of music, either classical music, baroque music, techno music, rock music, anything?
If it works for you, sure.
Okay. How about taking a shower?
I mean, I think it's a good idea in general. The reason why taking a shower may have a slight advantage is that it's something you do automatically, kind of like driving or brushing your teeth, where you're doing this thing and you're not thinking about it. And so it allows your brain to just process stuff. And so if you've been already thinking about a problem and you've done your research and you're thinking about it and you're a little stuck, then doing anything that is a little bit of an automatic process, and frankly, that could include, I guess, taking a walk, I mean, or a shower, it wouldn't hurt and it could potentially.
What about to get over writer's block and other sort of blank page problems, to just sit down and focus on the challenge and start doing something until you get into what some people call a flow state?
It doesn't sound specifically harmful, isn't it? It's one of those, is chocolate the best ice cream flavor? If you like it, sure. Is there mounds of evidence saying this is what you should do? Of course not. But it's also not something that I would say is against evidence.
And then finally, one of the very much more scientific ones that's only come out in the last couple of years, and it might be a bit technical for some people, but stimulating certain parts of the brain from the outside, something called transcranial direct current stimulation.
I wouldn't do it. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. So going back to your work specifically, what you're known for in the field is a lot of things related to the study and analysis of creativity. But one of the things you're most famous for is something called the 4C model of creativity. Could you let us know what that is and what the 4Cs are?
So there's always been this idea that there's a big C and little c. In other words, genius creativity and more everyday creativity. And along with Ron Baghetto, we expanded that a bit. We put a level below little c, which we called mini c, which is this personally meaningful creativity that may occur while learning, it may occur as a sudden insight, and it's something that other people might not necessarily think is creative. It might just be meaningful to you, but it's part of the creative process. And that it's something that it may never even be expressed, but it may start you on that journey to that would end up being to little c, where little c would be and other people would recognize, oh, that's creative. So if mini c is that time when you've bought a new guitar and you're just tinkering with it and you're trying, okay, what if I play these notes? That's mini C. By the time that you can now play a song and have other people choose to listen to you, that would be little c. Pro C is a more expert creativity level where you've been, you know, you've put in hours and years of deliberate practice and effort and trial and error and perhaps being mentored, and you've reached a level of expertise. So it could be something that you're now doing professionally or that you're generally recognized as being successful. And in general, that's the level that is reasonable and solid and good to aspire to in terms of, yes, I can absolutely do this. Big C, or the way that we view creative genius, is really a very retrospective thing. So we can guess people who we think will be remembered 100 years from now, but there's also an awful lot of luck, a lot of fate and chance and good PR that makes it very hard to predict. So like if I were trying to encourage somebody, I would focus on pro C and not big C, because if you focus too much on big C, I mean, frankly, most of us aren't. That doesn't mean what we're doing is not important or meaningful or a good thing for the world. And so some of the goal of the 4C model was to both, I mean, represent people in it, where big C, little c means either it's genius or everything else. And we were just trying to flesh out the everything else part.
And what has the research told us about how people can actually use this model? So it sounds like it's a bit of a theoretical model, but if people understand the difference between these four stages, are there things that they can do to enhance their overall creativity? Or is it an accumulation of lots of mini C's and little C's that'll eventually lead to a big C?
There's... For the mini C, the big application is education. It would be how you would respond to or reward a student. It would be being able to recognize creativity at this lower level that, frankly, a lot of people don't recognize it at. For little C and pro C, a lot of the things that would help you move up are things like creative metacognition, for example, which is having an understanding of your own creativity and knowing what your strengths and weaknesses are and being able to kind of predict, what will other people think of this? And you can grow that via feedback, via, I mean, practice, always practice. But also part of it is recognizing what are good times to be creative, what are less good times to be creative, what are situations that will help you be creative and help you pass along your creative ideas. What are situations where, there will be times when your boss or your teacher is not receptive and maybe don't share your ideas then. And this is something that I see as a large component to advancing and growing.
What do you say to people who don't have this self-perception of creativity, though? And it's one of the problems with today's society that so many people, if you ask them, are you creative or can you express your creativity or can you come up with good ideas, they'll be afraid and they'll say, no, I'm not.
One is to work on the creative metacognition. One is to fight arts bias. People assume creativity is in the arts. Not true. And to emphasize, I mean, not just things like business and science, but also everyday life, cooking. I mean, things that people do. I have yet to meet somebody who said, I'm really not creative, who wasn't creative in something. It's one reason why the idea of creative domains is very important to me, and I think to a lot of researchers, because we overlook so much. And then if people get the message that the only way you're creative is either as a genius or if you paint or write poetry or sing or act, then most of people will assume they're not creative and then they're not gonna keep trying.
Is there any research which has happened to find out why people have this feeling of unsatisfactory self-creativity or this feeling that they can't be creative? You mentioned an art bias, but is there anything that research has found about how people grow up, whether or not certain people are just born not creative, or whether or not everyone has the ability?
I have yet to see anything that indicates that people are born not creative. I think a lot of that is how we define or interpret creativity as a society. So there's a different model, the propulsion model, that talks about different types of creative contributions. And some of these, so for example, one is replication. And that's the person who, is at the art museum drawing their own version of the painting, or who, I mean, these days, creates their own punchline to a meme. That's not creative genius, but it is being creative. I mean, there's something actually I'm working on right now about just these hidden pockets of creativity, things that people overlook. And we label them, or certainly the person often will label it as not being creative. I mean, fan fiction or a lot of things that may be part of a typical day's work, but you can still be creative doing it. I mean, if you think of a way of sorting the mail that is faster or easier or more fun, then you're probably being creative at it, but people don't think of that as being creative. I think it's largely a social construct as to, I mean, I'm not saying everybody's a creative genius, and I think that's one of the big things the media does is that they will just mix up the word creative and genius, and they're not the same thing. I mean, I'm not saying everybody can be Mozart. It's not true, but everybody can be creative at something or can try to compose music or achieve some level of whether it's personal satisfaction or some level of accomplishment with a domain.
What do you mean by domains? Because this is something I've heard from some of the other speakers, and I know that you've done quite a lot of work into it. How does a domain of something affect someone's ability to generate ideas?
According to another theory, there are some. If you want to be creative, there are these basic initial requirements. And this is stuff like having a very basic level of motivation, not a type of motivation, but just to get off the couch. a very basic level of intelligence. I mean, again, not particularly high, in an environment that allows it. This is the work with John Baer. And then we can kind of argue for this pyramid where you have what we call general thematic areas. Others call them as broad fields, but that's like, visual arts or written art or not written art, but creative writing or business or social sciences, hard sciences. These are very large areas. Then under them would be what we would call domains. So psychology, anthropology, sociology, or if we're talking hard science, chemistry, physics. Even under there are what we might call micro domains, because these things aren't that simple. So the same way that creative writing might be writing poetry or writing short stories or writing creative nonfiction, even under poetry, you would have haikus and sonnets and all sorts of smaller distinctions. And there are different patterns associated. When I say patterns, I mean, different cognitive strengths, different personality traits, different interests, different, almost any attribute you could imagine. There are these different patterns associated with being creative, whether you're talking at the grand, at the general thematic area, or at the domain, or at the micro domain. There will be a lot less difference between two closely related micro domains. So, for example, creative writers and journalists, they're pretty similar, but there's also some differences. Whereas, let's say, creative writers and engineers, there might be a much larger difference.
I don't mean to oversimplify it, but I'm just trying to get my head around it, as I think a lot of the viewers and listeners are. Is this essentially saying that in order to be creative in a specific field, you need to have built up a certain level of either experience or skill or knowledge about the things in that field? Like, you can't write a good French poem if you don't speak French.
Absolutely that, as well as the fact that certain people will be more suited for different things, which again, some of that's kind of like, well, of course. But we don't really, because so much work considers creativity to be a more of a general thing, so you're creative or you're not creative, instead of, are you a creative poet? Are you a creative mathematician? We know a lot about what's associated with general creativity, but most people aren't creative in a general domain. Most people want to actually do something. Most people don't say, I want to be creative at anything. They'll want, I want to be a painter. I want to be a scientist. I want to be an architect. And that being creative in these different areas, so for example, let's say within psychology, a clinical psychologist and a cognitive psychologist. If we think about, okay, emotional intelligence, somebody who's better at regulating their emotions, understanding other people's emotions, somebody who's higher in that, probably better suited to clinical than cognitive. Not only, but that's kind of a little mark perhaps on that side. Somebody who is very high on analytic abilities, perhaps more cognitive. And obviously, I'm generalizing large, but if you think about conscientiousness, or are you extroverted or introverted, are you really good at visual spatial ability or not, are you interested in investigating things, there's all this stuff that if you consider who you are, what you're interested in, what you're good at, that can help lead you towards maximizing creativity. We just don't have all the research done yet. That would be nice to have.
And in your view, talking about the research again, what have been a couple of highlights as far as either new studies or statistics or evidence which have come out over, let's say, the last 10 years that you think have really helped push the field forward?
Been a lot of work And this is a methodology, which is going to sound boring, but on the consensual assessment technique, where it's a technique created by Teresa Mable. A lot of us have used it, where it's basically you have people do creative products and then qualified experts can evaluate it. And the thing that's counterintuitive is that people agree. You think that, everybody has their own opinion on what's creative, what's not creative. We agree a lot more than you think. And so there's been all these studies that have kind of pinpointed. So, for example, in an ideal world, you'd want experts. For a lot of reasons, that's just not possible. And that if you try to get complete novices, so random undergrads, they're not going to agree enough. But if you get people with just some level of expertise, so let's say that you're a teacher and you want to try to help give feedback to your students at a creative task, and that you're worried that your judgment isn't enough. I mean, English teachers show pretty solid agreement with actual published authors. Graduate students in English literature or in creativity, for that matter. It could be a matter of just, but let's say you had three English teachers who decided to, for the big project their students do, they all go over them, assign creativity ratings. They will generally agree at a very high level. And it all of a sudden, it goes from one person's feedback to actually, this is a reasonable reflection of whether or not of the level of creativity in this poem or final project, and a way of giving a very high level of feedback to students to help them grow and be more creative.
They might not necessarily agree on the quality of the content, but are you saying that in general, people with some domain knowledge will agree on how creative some content is?
And they'll agree more on the quality than you'd think. There'll be specific pieces they will disagree about. But if you're talking 40 or 50, then if you look at it at that level, they will come to a very high level agreement. And again, so you could pick one particular one and maybe the ratings will be all over the map. Usually, though, they will tend to converge and allow you to look at it as a larger unit. There's been a lot of very recent stuff looking at things like being creative with video games or just creativity in the digital world. I don't think we have enough of it yet, but we're finally starting. One of the more frustrating things is that because creativity is one of those things that people don't necessarily assume that you need an expert on, which is understandable and frustrating. You have these studies that will have all these resources, but they haven't consulted anybody in creativity. And so they use the incredibly flawed or downright stupid measures. So there was a recent study on creativity and mental illness that, clearly was a lot of money to run. It tested all these people, and the measures they used for creativity were horrible. And so the results to me were, they don't mean anything. It's a certain, I would love to see more interdisciplinary work, the same way I'd like to see more cross-cultural work, but we're not rewarded for it. We're told to keep in our silos. Interdisciplinary work tends to have a harder time being published. And so everybody says they want it, nobody wants to do it. I mean, most interdisciplinary conferences I've gone to have been people saying their thing, nobody understanding it, no attempt at integration, then you go home, but it was a nice location.
So we're coming up to the end of the session, but what I like to ask all the experts is if you've got one tip, one thing you've learned really works that you could share with our viewers, listeners on how they can improve their creativity, what would it be?
Mine would be two part. It's that all that stuff that seems too easy to be true is too easy to be true. And that inspiration is overrated. It requires the boring domain knowledge and revision type stuff. So make sure that what you're doing is something you love, because otherwise it's going to not be fun. But I think if you do what you love and you're enjoying it, then you can keep plugging along for the unpleasant parts.
Perfect. And we're going to get links on screen to all of your resources. Where are those links going to take people?
They'll be to my personal homepage, my department homepage. And probably the thing I update the most is my professional Facebook page. And then I'm also on Twitter.
Perfect. Dr. Kaufman, it's been wonderful having you here. And I look forward to speaking again with you soon.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on being part of the Innovation and Creativity Summit. I'm sure that if you continue to watch the other expert interviews, you will experience an improvement in your capability to turn your ideas into something valuable. But don't forget, to get the very best experience and ensure you don't miss any of the priceless lessons, you should invest in yourself with the All Access Pass. Not only will this give you exclusive lifetime access to watch all the lessons whenever is best for you, you will also get all the interviews as downloadable audio files so you can learn on the go, full transcripts so you can read and analyze the great advice and tips, and exclusive bonuses not available to anyone else. Click the link below to get your All Access Pass now.